Thanks for having me. This is joint with Roman Bezrukhavnikov. And this talk is going to basically presents results of some calculations, which happened before we knew what they were answering. And there's many people in the audience who, you know, have a better sense than me about what these calculations actually mean. So I'm hoping to, you know, solicit some advice in that direction. But here's the setup. So you start with, for me, a torus acting on some representation. You can imagine part of this talk taking place with a non-abelian group, but we'll stick to tori. And so you can write down some three-dimensional gauge theory. With this data, and you get two spaces, vacua, a Higgs space, or a Higgs branch, which is easy to describe. It's just a cotangent bundle of T star n, symplectically reduced by this torus. And here, this depends on some stability parameter theta. And if you pick theta to be 0, you get what I'll call y, which is kind of the spectrum of torus invariance, the space. So this guy is be singular and affine. And in our setting, this is going to be smooth, symplectic.
For generic theta.
For generic theta, yeah. And the second space people like to think about in this context, the Coulomb branch. So I'm gonna suppress the choice of theta here and mostly just write sub H for Coulomb, for Higgs, and sub C for Coulomb. So I'm just gonna do that right now. And this guy, well, for a long time, at least mathematically, it was sort of mysterious how to define this guy. And then three mathematicians known only by their initials, B, F, and N, you know, give some definition, which I'm not going to repeat here. There's a spectrum of some, well, it's prodge of some ring, maybe associated to its data, and maybe some co-character here. And there's also an affine version. Okay. So the running example that I'll have when our torus is equal to just C star, it's acting on C3, then the Higgs branch is the cotangent bundle of P2 and maps down to, well, some singular affine guy. Where you contract P2, leave everything else alone. And the Coulomb branch is this A2, well, resolution of an A2 surface singularity. So it's easier to write the affine guy here. X, y equals z cubed. And here we have the resolution. I'll just schematically draw the exceptional curve over the singular point. So this is the exceptional curve, exceptional fiber. Okay, so that's the setup. The original impetus for this project was Hikita's conjecture. There's a rather surprising relation between the Higgs and the Coulomb branches. It states the following. So on the one hand, you can take the cohomology of the Higgs branch. This is a ring. The claim is it's equal to something computed on the Coulomb side. It's not going to be the cohomology. So write this as O of Y Coulomb superscript E. So now I need to go back for a second. We started with a torus acting on N. The Higgs branch is gotten by a quotienting by this torus. On the other hand, the Coulomb branch will have an action of this torus, but it's dual. So. And what is this space? So by definition, this guy is sort of the right way to take torus fixed points on an affine scheme. So this is just what you get when you take all functions on Y and you mod out by any function that kind of, well, but you take covariance basically. So you think of this. This is an element of your torus, you mod out by the difference between any function and its translate. Okay, so Higita's conjecture is that these two things are equal as rings. And this should strike you as, you know, rather weird. These are very different flavor. Maybe not so weird in retrospect, knowing the construction of the Coulomb branch in terms of, you know, convolution algebras. But let me give an example. So we'll do this example. So again, T equals C star. Acting on C3. What is the cohomology of the Higgs branch? Well, that's just the cohomology of T star P2. So it's generated by a single Tren class of the tautological bundle. Whose cube power vanishes. All right. On the other hand, what is the sort of torus invariant ring in the Coulomb branch? So how do we take torus invariance here? We basically mod out by all of the variables that transform in some non-trivial way under the torus action. I haven't told you how to define this torus action in detail, but it scales x positively, y negatively, and leaves z alone. So this is equal to, you know, C adjoin x, y, z modulo the relation we started out with, and then modulo x equals 0, y equals 0. And so you just get C adjoin Z modulo Z cubed. And voila, these two rings are isomorphic. OK, but it's, again, it's. It's rather surprising. So what I want to do is propose a sort of categorical analog of the Kikuta conjecture. Analog.
In the story case, it's null, right?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot to say it. But Kikuta proved this conjecture in many cases. It was somehow known. More or less, you know, the pre-existing conjecture where the statement was known in some form for slow-to-a slices. And then Kikuta proved it for hypertoric varieties and for the Hilbert scheme.
Not for all slow-to-a slices. Right?
Slow-to-a. Some slow-to-a slices. And sort of my personal interest is not in proving it for more cases. That'd be great. But it's more like, you know, why the hell is this true?
What's the status of this for non-abelian groups?
Of the Kikuta conjecture? Here's where I admit that I've never read Kikuta's paper, and I have no idea what the status of his conjecture is in general. But I have talked to him.
What do you mean by general?
Well, like, I mean, what if he is in a non-abelian group?
No, see, first of all, formally, we need the resolution on one side. I mean, we can talk about it in the general context of symplectic duality if you have a resolution on one side.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the most general context you can discuss this. And then it's novel. I mean, I can tell you a list of things where I know that it holds, but you know, it's not. Well, general case, it's not known. And it's not known, and moreover, there's no proof. Maybe what Michael's going to try isn't a proof, but I mean, in all cases, when it's proved by basically just explicitly computing both sides.
Yeah. For what?
Okay. We, as in the both of you?
I can tell you the approach. I don't know for what.
So categorical analog of the Kikuta conjecture. So I should give you the basic template is the following. We have these two rings. Cohomology ring and this torus fixed ring. And I want to give you two categories, call them CH and C Coulomb, such that you sort of, both of these rings live in the center of the respective categories, in central actions. They're not equal to the centers, but they'll be kind of similar size. And then you have some equivalence of categories here. I won't exactly deliver on this promise, but that's the template.
If I only knew that top line, then maybe it's really nice, but if I only knew that top line, could I deduce the usual Kikuta conjecture?
So, how can I say? Without any further input, no. Because in the hypertoric example where we're working, the centers of these categories are bigger than these guys. They're like just slightly bigger. It's a finite dimensional algebra, just a slightly larger finite dimensional algebra that gives you the center. But somehow the center is maybe possibly more interesting than the ring you started with.
So you're saying, so I think you made the wrong conjecture and that you can deduce the correct one from this statement.
I would never say such a thing. let's just say we're using Hikita's conjecture as kind of the launch point, but I think the end statement is kind of interesting in its own right. So let's start with the Coulomb side, where we have kind of a firm grasp on everything. So recall we had our Coulomb scheme X mapping down to the singular guy Y. Singular. Then we have this fixed point subscheme, just the spectrum of this ring. And so what do? We take the derived fiber here. And we'll just call this XCF. I want to distinguish it from the torus fixed points of X, which it is not. So in our example, when Coulomb branches this resolution, this guy here is equal to some derived enhancement of, you know, of a fattening of the exceptional fiber. And so our Coulomb category, I'll write down in a second, but it's just going to be coherent sheaves on this gadget. So the derived category of, I keep writing T here, but I'm good. It should just be T check. Derived category of T check equivalent coherent sheaves on this funny thing. So maybe derived schemes are a bit of a pain to think about. It turns out we have a very explicit understanding of this category. So in a hypertoric case, possibly more generally, can use some results from paper with Ben Webster describe this guy. Basically as a category of modules over some explicit algebra. So mildly intimidating definition, but you really have a concrete handle on this. Okay? And then
does this guy depend on this parameter theta or not?
A priori it does.
No, I mean, a priori incentive does, but does it depend on this? I mean, like this derived fiber, does it depend on the parameter theta?
In general it will. The category, I'm not ready to say that the categories aren't, equivalent to each other, but the derived fiber will depend.
Yeah, the categories are definitely equivalent to each other as derived categories. But yeah, I mean, there are examples of...
Yeah, well, I mean, is it you mean because you can compute them, or I mean, how do you know that?
Well, because you have derived equivalences between the whole category coherent sheaves. That's going to match up. That's another thing that's in our paper.
Right.
But the
the actual fight was like, you can have examples where for one choice of theta, there's a P2 blown up at a point, and then for another choice of theta, you only see P2s.
So how does this category relate to our original ring here? Well, you know, so in general, functions on any scheme acts on,
hello.
It's bedtime. So, yeah, functions on any scheme act centrally on Courier and Sheaves on that scheme, just by, it's more or less what a Courier and Sheaf is. And so if you just add torus fixed points everywhere, you get an action of the Hikita's ring on this category. Acts on our category C, but again, this is not the full center. The full center is a little bit bigger. And if you're for the representation theorists in the room, if there are any, I'll just say this is related to, in the Springer case, this is related to the category of modules over the small quantum group. So. Any questions?
I'm going to say what the full center of this category is.
Not really. I mean, I can describe it, you know, concretely, but I don't have like a good
have like a meaning like this thing does.
Right. It's a good question. I mean, somehow it's something you're associating to the data, not just of the scheme, but of the scheme together with its fiber in the resolution. It's hard to say like how general you should try to make your definition.
Yeah, so for example, I think in this example that Michael mentioned, when you have a Springer resolution, then this thing is supposed to be the center of the small quantum group, or of the regular block of small quantum group. And I don't think this is well known, and there are various conjectures about it, but I think it's like this problem which has been there for years of the center. Regular block of the small quantum.
Right. If I had to guess, I would say that was Roman's original, you know, motivation for thinking about this in the first place.
Yeah, that would be.
And can I just ask a question that will probably only make sense to me and possibly to the other Ben, which is like, you know, we have this quiver description.
Yeah.
And doing this involves killing all the paths in that quiver that correspond to non-trivial elements of pi 1 in the torus.
Yeah.
Is there any derived screwed up stuff going on, or you just honestly take the algebra and mod out by those guys?
You just honestly take the algebra. Like somehow if you didn't take the derived fiber, then doing this would produce a bunch of garbage. But since you take the derived fiber, the algebra works out like cleanly.
And yeah, it's not the fiber, it's the pre-image of this scheme. Of this non-reduced scheme of fixed points.
Right. Sorry. Yeah.
Cartesian product.
The Cartesian product. Okay. So I've now told you how to fill in this side of the square. Now I want this side. And this side, the situation is kind of a mess, but. But it's a very enticing mess. So. So here's, you know, roughly what I'd like to do. So let L tilde of X Higgs be the universal cover of the loop space of X Higgs. So if you think about it, in because the Higgs space is simply connected, sorry, pi 1 of its loop space is equal to space of curves in here. And so this is some very infinite dimensional thing with an action of this lattice by Deck transformations. Okay. And so we're going to set out to find a category of sheaves on this space. Sort of dual to this category here, such that the Deck transformations will correspond to twisting by characters of T-check. And I think for many people in the room, this is actually not such a surprising thing to do, because by now there are many ongoing projects relating coherent sheaves on one side of, let's say, the Coulomb branch, and various sorts of constructible sheaves on loop spaces on the dual side. So this guy is, well, let's just say, should be symplectic, because it's just a loop space of a symplectic guy. So what we'd like is that our Coulomb, or our Higgs category, be just some subcategory of, let's say, many ways of calling this, but just microlocal sheaves on the universal cover of the loop space. So this is subcategory defined relative to a stability condition. Okay.
What does that mean? Like, this is the category of stable objects?
No, I mean something more ad hoc. Like you pick a certain parameter. This parameter tells you how to build a category that sits inside here. But not there's not no general procedure I'm applying.
Are you going to tell us though what this procedure is in this case?
How much time do I have?
What the flavor of it is? Like, is
it
like a singular support condition? Is it?
Fundamentally, I don't know what the correct geometric flavor is. I'll tell you how to construct such a category in the hypertoric case, but like it's a little bit mysterious what exactly we're doing.
Some particular objects and declare those to be your category.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
These objects are very nice, so somehow it's clearly something going on.
So what's the sort of symplectic structure on this loop space?
Well, it just in real terms, if you have what's the tangent space to a loop, all vector fields along that loop, given a pair of vector fields, you can, you know, integrate the symplectic pairing.
Yes, which isn't actually a symplectic form. I mean, it's degenerate. Maybe that's not important.
Yeah, no, I'm not kind of.
Sorry, who's degenerate? This pairing on
which pairing
on the loop space of
no. Just mean I have some vector space exclusive to the
XH is symplectic to begin with, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So okay. So more or less, the kind of objects I'd like in my category. Call them quantizations. And certain Lagrangians. L sub sigma, where sigma here, we're writing is an element of equivariant H2. Okay, so this is an extension of co-character lattice of the torus that acts on the Higgs space by just this guy here, which acts on the universal cover of X Higgs by Deck transformations. So we want to produce a family of Lagrangians indexed by these guys. Really indexed by a certain, let's say, subset of these guys, which I'll just write superscript, subscript alpha here.
That should say CH.
Where?
The first line.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
So on the other side, you use the resolution of the Coulomb branch. You used X of C instead of Y of C.
Yeah.
And so on this other side, right, you have an extra.
Which other side? Or
the Higgs side.
The Higgs side, okay.
You have an extra C star action around.
Yeah.
And you can use that to write down like a multi-valued potential on the loop space. And this thing you're writing should be like a Pacaya-Seidel category for that. Like, I mean, does your category depend on the resolution parameter on the other side?
It does. That's this alpha here.
Yeah.
So this alpha is, as Justin was saying, it's the resolution parameter for X Coulomb slash it's a choice of co-character, generic co-character, this flavor torus.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is that there's a natural multi-valued function on the loop space of the Higgs branch that's built out of this co-character. Or like the moment map for this co-character.
Right.
And like probably like this micro-local sheaf category ought to be just the Pacaya-Seidel category for this.
I'm happy to believe such a thing.
Yeah,
basically.
I mean, I know it doesn't matter because you're gonna use micro-local sheaf.
Well, it doesn't matter because you need to specify that.
I agree with you that that's probably the right way to think out which.
Another comment that will probably only make sense to the three of us, do you really mean resolution parameter or non-commutative resolution parameter? If you use blah to describe, that implies you're choosing a non-commutative resolution, not a commutative.
I don't know. Not sure I have a good answer to that.
Some sort of a condition.
So in elementary terms, what does this Lagrangian look like? Well, actually, Kevin was just explaining to me how to think about this properly, but let me give you the very lowbrow version. So this is some Lagrangian that retracts onto a copy X inside its loop space. So this map here, it's easier to describe its composition projection down to the regular loop space, not the universal cover. This just takes a point X to the orbit of X under the projection of sigma, which is just a co-character of the flavor torus. Okay, so you have a torus acting on X. So given any point on X, you get a loop. You just take the orbit of that point under the torus. The torus is higher dimensional. You don't get a loop anymore. But if you pick a co-character of that higher dimensional torus, you're back to getting a loop for each point. And so you get an embedding of X into its own loop space. And if you think about it, the way to lift such an embedding to the universal cover is just to extend the co-character lattice by the lattice of deck transformations.
Is there a picture you can draw? Can you illustrate to me what these Lagrangians, because I want, based on what Justin said, that alpha to be picking out a singular, like an asymptotic singular support condition, like some sort of tonical Lagrangian.
Yeah,
are moving along.
The sort of description in that vein would be something like the following. So you take again, let's think of sigma as a co-character, right? So the sigma, let's try sigma bar, let's say, for the composition for this projection. I'll just say it in words. There's two things you can do to a loop. You can try and flow it along the usual loop shrinking flow, or you can rotate it. Well, you can flow it by kind of composing with this co-character. And these guys are sort of the fixed locus for the sum of these flows. And these Lagrangians are like the attracting sets for these flows. So it's a very Fukuyasidal type description. I'm hesitant to make any firm statements to that effect, because I certainly can't directly compute anything about such a Fukuyasidal category. All right. I've told you that this thing should be built out of a bunch of Lagrangians, that these Lagrangians are indexed by these sort of extensions of co-characters, and actually by a certain subset of extensions. So let me say let me just say in words that it's the key part here is that we've sort of restricted the set of all such objects to kind of well-behaved subset. That's what we'd like to do. Sadly, we cannot do it. So instead, we have the following sort of combinatorial substitute. Oops. For the Higgs category. When does this talk normally end? At 1:30?
Yeah.
Okay. So the substitute A allows us to actually define, pose and then prove a theorem. But it's also maybe interesting because it provides an indication of how you'd compute x in this category. Okay. So the idea is to use GKM skeleton. Let me explain what that is. So let F be a torus acting on some space X. So we know from equivariant localization that the equivariant cohomology of X restricts to the equivariant local cohomology of its, sorry, that should be F, of its fixed point locus. And that moreover, this is a isomorphism after localization. Okay, so this is due to maybe it's Berlin and Vering or Atiyah Bhatt. I am no longer sure. Just write these two. So what GKM theory does, it tells you how much more stuff do you need to add to the fixed point locus to remove this caveat. Can you sort of enlarge the subset from a collection of points to something a little bit bigger, so that this becomes an isomorphism on the nose without localizing? Okay? So for spaces satisfying the whatever, GKM condition, it's enough to restrict not to fixed points, but to fixed points and one-dimensional orbits connecting fixed points. So we'll call this GKM skeleton. So this is again the fixed points plus one-dimensional orbits between fixed points. And this is actually this is kind of cool, and it's very hands-on theory. So let's just take a silly example like P2. So P2 you can replace by three fixed points and the three torus invariant lines between them. And you can recover the entire equivariant cohomology of P2 on the nose without any localization, just from basically this graph, plus the data of how does the torus act on each of these guys. Okay. Well, you can get certain constructible sheaves on P2. So that's the thing. You can get K-theory of P2. Mm-hmm. You can get elliptic cohomology of P2. You can compute, so what I'm leading up to is you can compute X of certain constructible sheaves on P2 this way. To my knowledge, you can't, without doing something very suspect, you can't just describe coherent sheaves this way. You sort of need some sort of constructibility to be able to sort of retract onto the skeleton in some sense. You know, who am I to say that you can't? But I don't know how. Yeah.
You need to have a situation where sort of big orbits make a very small contribution. Right. Equivariant cohomology, kind of the bigger an orbit is, the smaller contribution it makes. That's true with equivariant coherent shapes.
And so you could ask, well, and I would tell you, you know, how what is the explicit description of this ring in terms of this graph? But you if you know equivariant cohomology, you should be able to deduce it from this statement. Really, just the equivariant cohomology of this space, if you compute the usual way. But that, I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you sit down and think, what is the equivariant cohomology of a space that has only points in one-dimensional orbits, you'll find that there is a totally explicit algebraic description of this thing. OK. So, so we can also compute x of certain.
Sorry, this means literally taking the residue.
The restriction.
Restriction, sorry.
Yeah, restriction, yeah. Although, somewhat confusingly, the residue also enters in the further developments. So of you can take x of certain equivariant instructible sheaves. This way.
You remember what it means for the constructible?
So the simplest example is a vector bundle with a flat connection. Next simplest example is you take some subvariety of your space. You take a vector bundle with a flat connection on that subvariety. And then more generally, stuff that's kind of glued together out of those things in some horrible way.
It's to a system of differential equations.
Right. Right. Okay. So roughly the idea is the following. Given, let's say, one's a good say G inside the derived category of equivariant equivariant constructible sheaves on F, you produce an element called a G bar by the category of sheaves on gamma of X, where this is the graph of the GKN skeleton. Okay, so here's gamma of P2. It's the graph that has a vertex for each fixed point and an edge for each one-dimensional orbit. And there are some labelings that tell you how the torus acts. So there's a category of sheaves on this thing. And then in good circumstances, you can hope that basically that a statement like this holds. Okay, all right. So I'm being very sketchy here. But let me just say, how do we actually define a category, or rather, how do we try to concretely study this category of Lagrangians? What we do is we sort of write down a skeleton for the loop space. So write down GKM skeleton for the universal cover of the loop space, and then define analogs of our Lagrangians L sigma in the category of sheaves on this skeleton. Okay. And so in this context, so we can prove that basically the exists tilting bundle tau for the derived category of coherent sheaves on the Coulomb branch, fixed locus. And a collection of objects, call it L bar sigma. Bar sigma in the sheaf category. Such that endomorphism of this collection is equal to endomorphism of a tilting bundle, which is more or less telling you that these guys should be the images of a family of essentially causal dual to let me back up a little bit. So this tilting bundle is equal to a direct sum of line bundles. And what this is telling you is that we've constructed some sort of combinatorial avatars of the duals to the tilting summons, which are given exactly by these Foucault-Seidel style Lagrangians. Okay.
If I turn my resolution parameter to zero,
yeah,
what does that correspond to on the other side?
So which side are you going to zero in?
If I turn alpha to be zero. On the sort of spectral side, alpha was kind of the other side it was on. I mean, now on the Higgs side, if I turn alpha to zero,
yeah,
what collection of Lagrangians do I get over here? And that should correspond to like picking out like one particular Lagrangian, maybe, or
good question. So as alpha goes to zero on the Coulomb side, what's happening on the Higgs side is that you no longer have like a generic co-character of your torus, which means you're no longer working with like isolated fixed points. This is wild speculation, but I think presumably what you get is some sort of, you're just recovering something like the center of this category. So you're kind of forgetting the category itself, and you're just recovering the data of the ring.
Right. I'm trying to, on the other side of the thing, that's from the resolution.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the categories in the Schober for one of the smaller strata.
Right. Okay.
Right. This guy still has a Schober.
So yeah.
More singular categories that there maybe isn't such a great geometric interpretation of.
All right. So maybe I'll just end with kind of like questions for you guys. The one is, can you actually convince yourself that these GKM graphs compute? X in, let's say, this Fukuyacidal category, right? Because appear to have a correct answer, but not quite to the right question. And then
Fukuyacidal category
of this infinite dimensional loop space. So it's already a slightly wobbly
object. Is this not smart for like simpler spaces?
Well, I mean, if you're If you're willing to believe this statement here, that you compute X of constructible sheaves in certain cases. You need to, there's some conditions on, you can't, this doesn't work arbitrarily, basically. Then there are many theorems that convert constructible sheaves into Lagrangians.
I mean, that is the theorem of Rayton or something, or what?
Yeah, I believe so. And then the second question is, that's one. And the second question is to interpolate between, well, this is kind of related to Ben's question, but we'll add some extra spice. So non-zero alpha and theta and zero alpha and theta, where you're basically, on some level, the analog of this conjecture is something like the BFN construction. So the question is, can you sort of smoothly dial from one to the other?
What kind would interpolation do? Like,
I just mean, find a statement which is uniform for zero and non-zero stability parameters and recovers the BFN construction and maybe a slightly corrected version of this construction at both ends. This is some version of a question that I know Sasha has explained to me. So yeah, I'll stop here.
So in what cases have you actually proved this? You say can improve.
Hyper-torics. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm being a little bit sketchy here. I haven't given you a lot of definitions towards the end of the talk, just because I think these are, on some level, the wrong definitions. I don't wanna, go into the weeds. But you can make a precise statement and then prove it, basically to the fact that the X groups of these coherent sheaves are computed by various HOMs in this category of graph sheaves.
But so some of it, as you pointed out, I mean, the statement of Hikita conjecture has been known from the beginning for hypertorics.
Right. So this is not a good way to prove Hikita's conjecture, at least for hypertorics.
So the fact that if the thing is compatible with whatever is more
from Hikita.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, the way you prove it is by basically applying Hikita's conjecture infinitely many times. So you just you break this graph into many different subgraphs that basically look like the graph of X itself. Those compute the cohomology of X itself. You apply Hikita's conjecture to each of those subgraphs, and you show that basically the.
But how is looking at the X in this category? Yes. What would they know about it? It's like it's going to derive the preimage of some non-reduced scheme. I mean, what do they know about it?
So if you forget this derived preimage, you just take the total space. Then we have in my paper with Ben, we have a tilting bundle. For this category, and we can compute, its algebra of endomorphisms explicitly at some quiver algebra with relations. The point of taking this derived fiber is that actually the scheme itself is mysterious, but its coherent category is computed by just imposing a bunch of extra relations on that quiver algebra. So somehow, you know, the... No,
what do you actually mean by tilting bundle on a derived scheme?
Well...
I mean, if you, on the initial scheme, tilting bundle is a generator, and R more from itself, from this thing to itself is concentrated in 1 degree, which is zero. So so if your scheme is derived, then somehow it's kind of strange to expect such a thing.
Fair enough. Fair enough. The claim is fundamentally that, so you know, maybe this is a...
Well, true or false, the endomorphism algebra of this tilting bundle is concentrated to degree zero.
True.
Okay.
The...
How is it possible? Oh, you're saying that it's a derived scheme, but they're saying that but they're saying that if you take functions on this derived scheme, it's called, you know, they live in degree zero. Is that true?
I believe so. I will admit that I'm in some amount of doubt.
If that were not true, then there would be no hope for that to have a bundle because
right.
Derived in a more constrained degree zero. We both have functions inside.
So the statement is really not that, how can I say it? The statement is that you start with this tilting bundle on the ambient space, you compute its algebra of endomorphisms, and then you prove that some quotient of this algebra describes the category of this guy here. And then maybe, you know, you call the restriction of the line bundles to this derived scheme, you know, a tilting bundle, but
I mean, somehow I think, Michael, what you're saying is implicit in this claim is the claim that you know, derived fiber product really is an honest scheme.
No, that I...
Like, there's no way that this could work out unless that's just a normal scheme, even if it's not completely obvious from the way it's usually described.
Maybe you can just say what it is in the Z mod in the you know C2 mod Z3 case.
For C2 mod Z3, yeah. I mean, I can describe the category as a category, rather the derived category.
Z2, maybe the
yeah. Case. Well.
Say what the scheme is like.
You
know, it's like it's not a P1 or what
right. So
the underived thing is P1, but now.
No. The underived thing is already not P1. It's like a fattening of P1.
Okay.
So it's a preimage of z squared equals zero.
Right. Okay. The underived map. Thing is the beginning of P1, and then the derived thing is what?
Well, again, so somehow the. The whole point of the proof is to avoid ever computing the actual derived structure
okay.
of this thing.
It can't be that hard. We're talking about the derived structure on P1.
Yeah, so, okay, well, you know, it's presumably like you take, I mean, some. I was talking about this with Kevin over lunch. Maybe some two-term complex over P1. Maybe the structure sheet for this guy. But if I try to do this calculation on the board, I may screw it up.
Okay.
Probably will. So yeah. You're right, it's probably not that hard, but it's just somehow not